The prison population in this country has been growing steadily since the 1980s, and now one in every 100 American adults is behind bars. How shocking is that? Or how appropriate? Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, July the 29th. We will talk this hour with the writer of Slammed, Welcome to the Age of Incarceration, who looks at the prison system in the United States and talks about why it needs to be reformed. We will welcome your thoughts and questions about this. Jennifer Gonerman is a contributing writer to Mother Jones magazine. Her article, Slammed, Welcome to the Age of Incarceration, is in the July-August issue. She is also the author of a 2004 National Book Award finalist for her book, Life on the Outside. And Jennifer Gonerman joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, what prompted this article in Mother Jones?
Well, in the most recent issue, Mother Jones actually published, I wrote one article, but they actually published a total of seven on the subject of Welcome to the Age of Incarceration. And I think the numbers are just what propelled the magazine to want to take a much closer look at what's going on nationally in terms of our booming prison population.
Yeah, so why has the prison population boomed in the past couple of decades?
Well, I think largely it has to do with our so-called war on drugs, the way that we are punishing people arrested for drug crimes has become so much more severe. That's basically led to our massive prison boom.
Yeah, and so there are people behind bars. Most people behind bars don't belong there?
Well, it's hard to generalize like that, but there's a lot of people in prison who are there for much longer sentences than a lot of experts think that is required. I mean, that's what makes the United States different from so many other countries around the world. It's not so much that we send more people to prison, it's that we send our citizens to prison for far longer sentences. For example, in our country, it's no big deal if somebody, or perceived as no big deal, if somebody gets a 10-year sentence. Whereas in another country, it might be unheard of for someone to get such a stiff sentence. So that's largely, that's in part what's led to this massive incarceration boom where we now have, as you said, one in 100 American adults behind bars.
And you write, one in nine African American men between the ages of 20 and 34.
Yeah, that's one of the most sort of disturbing and startling statistics involving the prison system right now.
Yeah, why does this matter?
Why does it matter?
Yeah.
Well, when you lock up one person, it's really not just that individual life who's affected. The family, the community is incredibly affected. I mean, there's a very, very steep cost, both obviously financial to pay for somebody to be locked up, but also a human cost that gets paid by that individual and their entire sort of, community. And when you do this again and again across the country, you can really sort of decimate entire neighborhoods so that the idea of going to prison is no longer sort of unusual, but instead viewed as a rite of passage and really, can disrupt the sort of the family ties that hold communities together.
Yeah. Well, you also write that apparently now states are facing a financial crisis over all of the people who are behind bars, and maybe this is what's going to prompt some reforms, some changes?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I mean, the prison system has gotten so massive that many states simply can't afford to keep it going at the size that it currently is. So Kansas and Texas and at least 11 other states are trying out new strategies to curb their prison costs, trying strategies like reevaluating their parole policies rather than locking up every parolee who breaks even the smallest rule. They might try to work with that parolee and keep them on the outside, which obviously saves money for everybody.
Yeah. And what else? What other reforms do you think are called for?
Well, I mean, there's many, many reforms that can happen. Our entire prison system in the last few decades has really shifted from a model of rehabilitation to one that's about pure punishment. I mean, there was a time when we thought about, as a country, we thought about prisons as a place where you send somebody so they could be reformed or corrected. That's why we, in some states, still call them correctional facilities. But that mission has all but been abandoned. And nothing makes this clearer than the fact that we've shut down, and this goes back to the mid-90s, when Congress eliminated Pell Grants for prisoners, the nation effectively shut down virtually every one of the 350 prison college programs across the country, despite the fact that numerous studies have found that such college programs or education behind bars drastically reduces the odds that an inmate will commit another crime and go back to prison.
Yes.
So there may be no better way to try to rehabilitate a prisoner, but it's something we're simply not doing anymore as a nation.
Yeah. Talk some about your book, Life on the Outside. That was, you followed a woman who was imprisoned and what happened to her when she was released some, 16 years later.
Yeah, exactly. I did this book, Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett. And Elaine Bartlett was a prisoner in New York State for 16 years. She had gone in at age 26 on a first-time drug crime. At that point, she had four small children. They were all under the age of 10. And when she was released 16 years later, of course, they were all grown up, all pretty much adults themselves. And the book tracked her from her release in the year 2000 over the next 3.5 to 4 years as she tried to find her way in the world, as she tried to find a job, a place to live, as she tried to reconnect with her children and her larger family. And it really drove home the point to me how incredibly difficult it is to make that transition from life behind bars to establishing yourself in the outer world. And, you know, as our nation's prison population has grown, we've made it incredibly difficult, much more difficult, for people to try to make this transition. I mean, depending on what state you live in, people coming out of prison can be denied public housing, student loans, driver's license, welfare benefits, and a wide, wide range of jobs. So, you know, I mean, that's part of the reason why we have such an incredibly high recidivism rate in this country. I mean, there's many factors there, but, you know, at this point, something like about half of the people coming out of prison will be back behind bars within 3 years.
Yeah. You know, you do feel sorry for some people, like the woman you tell in your story, but then others will say, what about, you know, the pain caused all the other families who are the victims of these crimes? Maybe, the people who this woman sold drugs to.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this particular case, it was her crime involved carrying a package of cocaine from New York City up to Albany, our state capital, in a setup. A so-called friend had asked her to carry the package in exchange and promised her $1,500, and she had done it and ended up unwittingly handing it to an undercover officer, and that's how she ended up getting arrested. So the question of, I mean, obviously there's tremendous pain out there, and there's a reason that we have prisons, and obviously if you're the victim of a violent crime, you have one perspective. But on the other hand, you know, not everyone in prison is there because they committed a violent crime, and that's what we were talking about earlier when we're talking about, the ways that the country has changed in terms of how it punishes people arrested for drug crimes is largely how we've come to the point where we've got this massive, massive prison industrial complex.
Yeah. Do you see any besides these states who are looking at their, you know, parole systems or maybe some alternatives to locking up people who have committed some sort of drug crime? Do you have hope that that there's going to be some reforms on a national level?
Well, back in April, Congress passed the Second Chance Act, which provides federal grants to programs that help prisoners reenter society. So that was hopeful in some ways. I mean, obviously it takes more than one piece of national legislation to really dismantle this whole system that's been built. But I think the plight of people coming out of prison, the focusing on what happens to them once they're released and what their lives are like, is starting to happen now in a way that it hadn't, say, 10 years ago. And obviously that's very important because we're releasing so many people coming out of prison every year. That obviously we have to pay attention to what happens to them, or they're probably going to end up right back behind bars.
We are talking with Jennifer Gonerman. She is the author of a piece in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine, Slammed, Welcome to the Age of Incarceration. Talks about why one in every 100 American adults is behind bars right now and what needs to happen to reform the U.S. prison system. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 20 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, July the 29th. I hope you stay tuned. Coming up later this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 6. Look at this. After 4 o'clock, Ben Marins talks with Libertarian presidential candidate Bob Barr about his party platform as well as his views on the issues of the day. So your chance to talk with a presidential candidate, the Libertarian candidate for president, Bob Barr, with Ben Marins this afternoon after 4 o'clock. Right now, we're talking about the American prison system and why it needs to change. We are talking with a guest who says that the prison system is too expensive to sustain, that the costs, financial and societal, are requiring us to rethink prisons and reforming prisons. Jennifer Gonerman, contributing writer to Mother Jones magazine, her article Slammed, Welcome to the Age of Incarceration, appears in the July-August issue of the magazine. We welcome your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Robert in Rhinelander is our first caller. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to say that years ago, William F. Buckley, the conservative advocate, had advocated the legalization of all drugs with specific age limits, and that the war on terror is similar to the war on drugs, especially given the recent bill, H.R. 1955, which is really very vague in its wording on domestic terrorism. Whatever happened to Johnson's war on poverty? Or the war on hunger, or a war that declaring war on something that we could actually win. Local jail spaces, for instance, Lincoln County specifically, the county next door to me, farms out a lot of its jail space, and as a consequence, by keeping people in jail for lesser crimes and nonviolent crimes, lets people go for things like molesting children, actually, literally. Just yeah. A couple of weeks ago, somebody got a month. Less than a month in jail,
Robert. I'm sorry that I'm cutting you short. It sounds like you have a lot of examples, but it's difficult to hear you. We have a pretty weak connection, telephone connection. But I think you got the gist of it, Jennifer Gonerman. Maybe we should be legalizing drugs was one point that Robert made. What do you think?
Well, there's a lot of people that seem to believe exactly what he's saying, that this might be one of the answers to dealing with, you know, our problem in terms of our massive prison system. But he also voiced, it sounds like, a lot of frustration with the prison system, with the priorities, with the execution of justice. And I think that's something that's widespread, and people are just sort of tired and fed up, I think, with, you know, reading in the paper that this individual didn't get the punishment they deserved. And I think there's sort of a general sort of confusion and frustration with how this system has been working or not working for the last few decades, and that to really overhaul and rethink it is something that's certainly called for at this point.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Next we go to Dave in Appleton. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I'd like to thank your speaker for bringing this topic up. I have somewhat of a personal experience with my son, who's been incarcerated, and he has a college degree, in fact, from the University of Wisconsin, and spent time in jail, and really can't get his life started because of this. And this is with a college degree, and he's had problems primarily related to substance abuse, so not really in terms of violence to others or, you know, damage to property, things like that. Primarily, he's been the major victim, and he continues to be, and I'd love to see some form of reform.
Yeah, what do you, I mean, it's, what would help, do you think, Dave?
You know, certainly people have the right to Wisconsin Circuit Court access on the Internet, but that, for example, really limits his job opportunities because, frankly, people check that, and sometimes you don't get beyond the initial interview stage. So I'd like to see some perhaps vocational rehabilitation, retraining, or some sort of assistance somewhere along the line on how to get restarted once you've been incarcerated.
Yeah. Jennifer?
I think he's exactly right. I mean, it's not, there's nothing like having a loved one locked up and go through this system and to get a firsthand look and a real education in how things don't work to make somebody, you know, to radicalize somebody and make them really realize that the system needs to change in terms of really helping people when they get out of prison to make that transition into the world so that they don't end up cycling in and out of prison over decades.
Yeah, Dave, how's your son doing today?
Well, he's actually back incarcerated again, and primarily because, not to make others responsible, but I think life is quite tough when you're in that position, and of course, you know, people put themselves there, but once you're there, it's very hard to get out.
Yeah, I know there's a... I bet. Dave, I'm sorry. Thank you very much for sharing your story. You know, there is a law on the books in Wisconsin that employers are not to discriminate on someone's prison background. I know at least the state of Wisconsin in hiring is not allowed to do that unless there was a direct connection between the job and what the crime was. But that really doesn't help a lot, Jennifer. Sometimes some people see that conviction and there'll be a different reason they don't hire that person, right?
Exactly. I mean, people coming out of prison are faced a bit with this catch-22. You know, often they don't want to reveal a felony conviction for fear they're not going to get the job. But then, of course, if they don't reveal it, they're not telling the truth, and ultimately they'll probably be found out anyway, if not found out before they get the job. At some point, when they have the job, they're sort of always walking on thin ice, wondering when it's going to be revealed. And then, of course, if they do reveal it going right into the job interview, there's a steep chance they won't even get that job. So it's a very hard situation that your caller's mentioning.
Yeah. Doing some sort of job training that's maybe worthwhile job training in prison would presumably help, too. Didn't the woman in your story leave prison with, you know, no training, no money, no place to live, completely on her own?
You know, the woman I wrote about, Elaine Bartlett in New York, it was a little bit of an unusual case because at the maximum security women's prison in New York State, they actually had a prison college program. Even though they have been shut down across the country, people had come together, individual funders, to keep this program alive. So when she left prison, she actually had a two-year college degree, which put her 10 steps ahead of the average person coming out of prison. Still, it was incredibly difficult to find a job. It was almost like having a college degree and maybe having a college degree and having a felony conviction almost canceled each other out and became incredibly difficult nonetheless. But you have tons and tons of people coming out of prison with no skills, many of whom can't even read and write and are trying to make it in today's job market where it's hard to find a job for anybody, even without a conviction.
Our next caller is Ione in Neenah. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. One of my concerns is we spend, $1,500 to $2,000 a year for each child for education on the average. Yet we're willing to spend $50,000-$60,000 a year per person to keep them imprisoned. Why can't we do a better job on the education end so they don't go to prison?
Yeah, what about that?
Oh, I mean, she's exactly right. If we spent less money on prison, of course, there'd be more money for education. I mean, that's the sort of sad reality about this booming prison system is that the more dollars you put into the prison system, the less you have for public universities, for health care, for fixing potholes. So while we've built this massive, massive prison system across the country, we've really bankrupted ourselves in other ways.
Yeah. Do you know, Jennifer, if these states that have been offering now more alternatives to prison for especially nonviolent drug offenders, if those alternatives to incarceration are proving, besides keeping people out of prison, are they doing any good?
I think so. I mean, it's very hard to generalize because, you know, programs vary state to state around the country, but there is a real shift in thinking about whether we should be locking up everybody who has an addiction or whether we should be providing other alternatives, you know, like obviously treatment early on so that we don't have an addict cycling in and out of prison again and again.
Yeah, but you're not, we're not sure. There aren't statistics necessarily that say these people are getting treatment and getting off of drugs and not recommitting crimes for drugs.
Well, I think there are statistics like that. I mean, I don't have any in front of me right now, and I think it would, you know, those outcomes would vary state to state and program to program. So it's a little hard to generalize, but certainly it is, you know, cheaper and a greater chance of good results if somebody is diverted early in the process rather than becoming a prisoner again and again.
Jim in River Falls, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Great program. As a matter of fact, your earlier caller, Robert, was talking about the situation in Lincoln County, and I'm familiar with that area, and they're, in fact, having to build a brand-new jail complex because they're having to ship inmates all over the area because they don't have the room to house them in the current facility. But my question more went along the lines of, you talked about these low-lying offenses, and I've been around for 50-some years, so I know the criminal justice system and folks that have been involved in it as well. And it seems like that the folks I know who have money or wealthy are well off, hire attorneys and get minimal, if no, jail time, while the poor folks who have to go through the public defender system generally end up incarcerated for sometimes what seems like crazy periods of time for exactly the same offenses. And so I'm just wondering if it doesn't have more to do with poverty and resources is why we have this booming population, particularly in the 1 in 9 black young men.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that, Jennifer?
Sure, your caller certainly makes an excellent point. I mean, the haves and the have-nots, it all becomes incredibly clear the minute somebody is arrested. For example, if someone's arrested and they can't make bail because they're too poor, that they're being held in jail, as they go to their court dates, obviously they look far worse. They look far worse. They're not sleeping well. They may not have any clothes to wear. They may just be showing up in a uniform as they're going and making their court visits. So it's almost like they're doomed from the outset, whereas the person who did make bail is sleeping at home, rested, eats breakfast before they go to court, and, you know, shows up looking good and tries to impress the judge. And just from the very first moment that they enter the system, their paths, you know, go in two different directions. And the person with the money who can afford a private attorney who can put more time into their case and perhaps hire an investigator to investigate the strength of the allegations is in a very, very different position from the person who's, you know, 1 in 100 on the caseload of an incredibly overworked public defender and, you know, is just sort of a number in the system and never really gets the opportunity to make a strong case in their own defense.
Our guest is Jennifer Gonerman. She is the author of an article in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine, Slammed, Welcome to the Age of Incarceration. Our next caller is Kathleen in Gresham. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just say that I think that Jennifer's doing an absolutely superb job of summarizing some of the problems inside. And if she could cover some of the illnesses, TB, hepatitis, AIDS, that is just running rampant inside, and these women are not getting tested. Let me give you an example. I'm an activist for women in prison in Texas, and when that man said they're incarcerated for crazy periods of time, I'm just sitting here at my desk writing letters for two women with nonviolent crimes who I've known for 9 years, who have done every bit of schooling and rehab they possibly do inside. They committed their crimes at 19 years old, nonviolent crimes, drug-related. They have each served 17 years of their 40-year sentences.
My God, 40 years?
Texas. 40-year sentences. Once you get involved in the system and find out what's really going on, believe this woman that's speaking. These 40-year sentences, and they're still in there, and I'm fighting to get them on parole, and they have good homes to go to.
Yeah, what's going on with this, Jennifer? I mean, that does seem absolutely excessive for a drug crime, a nonviolent drug crime. Are laws like three strikes and you're out getting involved in this, too?
Well, I'm not an expert on the Texas system. Your mm-hmm. caller would know better, but, you know, Texas, you know, is known for having incredibly steep sentences, so it doesn't really surprise me. I'd love to know some more specifics of exactly what the crimes were. I mean, the amount of time that you're going to do for a drug crime obviously varies from state mm-hmm. to state, but she is absolutely correct when she makes the point that once you get caught up in the system, actually getting out of it and breaking free is incredibly difficult, and that initial crime will chase you through your whole sentence, so that no matter whether you never do anything wrong inside prison and you pursue every program and do everything you can to try to improve yourself and get out, you can find that you're just sort of caught in a situation that you can't escape.
Yeah, well, it sounds like some sort of sentencing reforms need to take place too. Kathleen, do you have any idea if they're?
I have their rap sheets.
Mm-hmm.
I have their past history. One of them committed 3 burglaries, one right after the other, and that's her whole rap sheet.
Yeah. And so 40 years in prison for that, it might be. And you originally called Kathleen to talk a little bit, too, about all the AIDS and other diseases that are running rampant through prisons. Jennifer, have you researched much of that?
I'm not really an expert on that. I mean, obviously, different states do a better or worse job of trying to treat their own inmates. But, you know, as our prison population has boomed, the cost of health care for prisoners is extraordinary, and obviously states are required to provide some kind of health care.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, our prison population is aging, and this is where the expenses really get become extraordinary, is because obviously as inmates get older, they have more health problems, and the states are required to take care of them. And you know, there are some states where portions of prisons look like old age homes, you know, with incredibly elderly people who are sickly, who are stuck behind bars.
Kathleen, thank you very much for the call. Frank in Castle Rock is with us now. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for this program, and I think we have to pay a lot more attention to this because it really is an abomination what's going on with the prison sentencing, especially in some communities in the state. One thing I wanted to, if I could just read one little brief sentence from our current governor's father, when he was a sitting federal judge. It was Federal Judge James Doyle. He wrote in a case, "I am persuaded that the institution of prison probably must end. In many respects, it is as intolerable within the United States as was the institution of slavery. Equally brutalizing to all involved, equally toxic to the social system, equally subversive to the brotherhood of man, even more costly by some standards, and probably less rational." That's what our current governor's father thought of the prison system. There's a group in Milwaukee now. It's called Prison Action Milwaukee, whose families of incarcerated who are forming to counter the insanity of the prison system here in Wisconsin, where 70% of the incarcerated are nonviolent offenders.
What's the group trying to do?
Well, they're trying to pressure the parole commission to release prisoners as they should have been released. I mean, the trend has changed since the mid-90s when the Clinton administration gave grant money to the states. Wisconsin got at least $12 million to increase sentences, to hold people longer. There was an incentive program and to push through truth in sentencing. So this is something that was really planned and instigated or facilitated by the Clinton administration and the federal government. But the group in Milwaukee is trying to pressure the parole commission to really look at people who have done their programs, who have served their minimum requirement, which is 25% of the original sentence, and who've been model prisoners, and they're still retained inside the prison system, really for no reason other than ideological. And it really subverts the intent of the court when they were sentenced the prisoner. They sentenced somebody to 40 years. The judge knew when he was sentencing him that he was supposed to serve a 10-year sentence. If he did that sentence properly without any conduct reports or trouble within the prison, he should be released. That's really what the parole system originally intended. But these guys are being held to their mandatory release date, which is 2/3 of their time, which is really an extension, just holding people longer than they need to be in.
Yeah, is this ideological, Jennifer?
Oh, I'm sure it certainly is. The same situation has been being played out in New York State in recent years, so that you go in thinking you're going to do one amount of time if you follow all the prison rules and do everything right, and then you find out that actually your sentence is turning out to be twice as long because, say, policies have changed or the governor has changed, and suddenly your sentence has changed and lengthened as a result. But I think that, you know, your caller mentioned a group in Milwaukee of family members of inmates trying to change this, and I've seen again and again that really when you have family members who become activists, who speak out against the system, it can be incredibly effective. I mean, it puts the lie to the idea that when you lock somebody up, they're the only person that is affected or the only person that suffers. I mean, of course, there's families and neighborhoods and entire communities who are affected by every individual's incarceration. So having a bunch of people, a bunch of family members speak out publicly can be a very, you know, very effective means of advocacy.
We're talking about U.S. prisons and prison reforms and welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, who is Jennifer Gonerman, a contributing writer to Mother Jones magazine. Her article, Slammed, Welcome to the Age of Incarceration, appears in the July or August issue of Mother Jones. She's also the author of the book, Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett, which follows the odyssey of a woman who was sentenced to 16 years in prison for a first offense of selling cocaine, and how she didn't have much when she was released. So what happens when you lock up one in every 100 American adults? And while she says America is expert at turning citizens into convicts, we've forgotten how to transform convicts back into citizens. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Veronica Rickard in for Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock, talking with the author of How to Watch TV News. That's coming up after 9. We're talking about prison reform. Talking with the author of the article Slammed, Welcome to the Age of Incarceration, that's in the current issue of Mother Jones. Here's an email from David in Madison. Jennifer, do you think that electing a black president might help prison reform? With 1 in 9 young black men incarcerated, I've got a hope that a President Obama might make prison and sentencing reform a priority. Do you?
I certainly have that hope, but you know, I'm not. But it is just a hope at this point. I mean, on the campaign trail, Barack Obama has obviously mentioned this a few times, but it certainly isn't something that he's been talking about a lot. So it's hard to know how much of a priority it would be. I certainly hope that if he were in the White House, that it would be a priority, and that we would have some real common sense in this area for once, and some new thinking about the criminal justice system.
Yeah, Brad in Phillips is with us. Hi, Brad.
Hi, it's a really good topic. Thanks a lot for asking or for having me on. Mm-hmm. I run help run a addiction recovery program in the jail, and this is not to fault our particular jail, but the fact is most of the people that are in there, that this is certainly the largest treatment facility, except there's no treatment going on inside of any of those places. Probably 60, 70, 80% of the people in there are drug and alcohol users.
Yeah, what do you mean there's no treatment?
I mean, well, they get to go to treatment outside. I mean, they go to counseling or something like that, and but essentially they get into jail. And they go in the in and out sort of thing. First of all, you go to jail, and, you know, the second time you're there for a week, well, essentially they lose their jobs or whatever. You know, that changes their whole life. You know, it's not just jobs, et cetera, but, you know, the fact is, you know, that's pretty severe punishment. I'm not just here to say that severity doesn't have its place. I'm just saying that it should be treated entirely differently. This, at least, particular drugs and alcohol,
as opposed to
just regular people that are in there.
How should it be treated differently, Brad? What would help? What would make it better?
Well, I think they should go to alcohol and drug treatment per se, instead of sitting in jail. And I'm not here to advocate. You know, it's just a completely different situation. And it doesn't work for alcoholism or drug addiction. It would have never really helped, you know, in me in particular. You know, we just, you know, when you get severe punishments, you know, it would have made me just that much madder. And, you know, I would have just said, well, the heck with it. I'm just going to do, if they want me to drink, you know, drink, if you will, I'll just do it. And that's just kind of the way I was, and I think a lot of us are.
Yeah. Oh, so you were an offender too?
Yes, I wasn't an offender technically, but I am in recovery program.
I see. You know, I was confused though, Brad, and I don't mean to be dense, but I thought you said you were running a drug treatment program.
Not a drug treatment. We have meetings in the jail for a recovery program.
All right.
Once a week.
Jennifer?
Well, your caller is certainly correct in talking about the absolute need for, you know, very good and effective drug treatment, and that being at the sort of one of the cores of the problem here of why we have so many people cycling in and out. And as he said, you know, the minute that you're locked up for a week and you lose your job, sometimes you may also lose your apartment. You know, trying to jumpstart your life after that is incredibly difficult, and often people sort of find themselves, you know, almost sort of circling the drain, going down and down after, you know, one misstep. And I think it's the lack of treatment options on the outside before somebody ends up in jail that's, you know, a big part of the problem here.
Brad, thank you so much for the call. John in Marshfield is with us now. Hi, John.
Good morning. Yes, I want to interject some objectivity into this conversation. 20 years ago, everyone in America was clamoring for truth in sentencing. They wanted 20 years to mean 20 years, not out in seven.
Mm-hmm.
Now that they've got it, everybody complains about the cost of prison life, and nobody wants to pay for it. The other thing I want to point out
is... Hold on, John. Let's just get a response on that. He's got a point, doesn't he, Jennifer? There was sort of a clamor for this, you know, life means life or truth in sentencing.
Right. I mean, he certainly has a point. And I think a lot of that clamoring came from a sense of fear. I mean, I think our media has played a sort of large part in all of this, you know, with the rise of television news, with the rise of the concept that if it bleeds, it leads, meaning if it's a crime or a bloody event, it would lead the evening news, at the beginning of the evening news, has really affected the way people think about crime. So while the crime rate may be going down, you could also see at the same time the amount of crime being covered, especially violent crimes, being covered on the television news going up. So it really created sort of a sense of fear nationwide and a frustration with the system and a sense that we really needed to crack down and, just as your caller said, put people in prison for longer. And while there is some truth to that, I think this sort of rampant fear is part of what was driving that frustration and that sense that we needed to lock people up for longer periods of time. I mean, there may be no better example of that than in Michael Moore's Bowling for Columbine, where he shows all these people living in incredibly low crime areas putting, you know, 10 locks on their door because they're so terrified of being the victim of a violent crime.
Yeah. And John, I'm sorry, you had another point?
Yeah. It is my understanding, although I can't substantiate it, that the prison system is not allowed to turn a profit. This might have come from manufacturers' associations, bureaus, that they don't want to compete with prisons. But prisons are actually set up in the state of Wisconsin that they could turn a profit and actually self-sustain between crops that they grow on the prison grounds, manufacturing facilities within the prison, that they could be set up to be self-sustaining but are not allowed to.
Yeah. So do you think they should do that?
I think it would keep inmates busy, teach them skills, teach them responsibility that would serve them well outside when they finally did get out, and pay for the prison system itself.
Yeah. Have you heard of such a thing in other states, Jennifer?
Well, there's a tension about whether jobs on the outside, you know, for example, a union job, a job that puts somebody in the middle class, whether that should, you know, obviously people don't want to see jobs like that go behind bars where somebody's being paid 25 cents an hour to do a job that somebody on the outside could support a family with, just in the interest of self-sustaining a prison. So I think there is a sort of a tension there. But this question of whether prisons turn a profit, I mean, obviously, we now have private prisons in this country where the sole purpose of them, I think, is to turn a profit. I mean, obviously, that's not the majority of prisons. It's still a small, relatively small number, but it is a growing number, and it's, you know, it's a factor in all of this.
Yeah. Thanks, John, very much for your call. Mike in Bayfield County is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. The point that I wanted to raise has to do with the plea bargain and the length of the prison sentence. If an accused does not agree to a plea bargain, trying to work things out, but demands under the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution a trial by jury, the prosecutor will then say, okay, fine, you can have your jury trial, but he'll tell the lawyer for the accused that we're going to throw the book at you, and we're going to ask for the maximum sentence. So a lot of people who end up deciding to go through the jury system, as a result, they end up spending a longer period of time than they would have if they had agreed to a plea bargain.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer?
Yeah, your caller is absolutely right. I mean, the whole plea bargain, he's captured it exactly. In the case that I wrote about in the book, life on the outside. The individual, Elaine Bartlett, she was offered a plea bargain of 5 years, and she turned it down. She thought she hadn't committed a crime. She ended up getting 20 to life, sentenced by the judge after she lost a trial, and her co-defendant got 25 to life for the same crime. So there is a sense that not only do you sort of lose your chance if you don't take the plea bargain, but I think in her case, and in a lot of cases, you have a judge who will say, well, not only are we going to give you this punishment because you committed the crime and were convicted, but also for, you know, using up our time and our court resources, we're going to punish you a little bit more and throw in some extra years. I mean, obviously it's unstated, but I think there is a perception that if you do exercise your right to a jury trial, you will be punished, perhaps more than you deserve.
And we move now to Charles in Ingleside, Illinois. Good morning.
Good morning. I called my representative recently, and she said that we're spending $17 billion a year for the drug eradication. Now, we have 435 representative districts in this country. That means that we're spending $4 million per representative district. We have two here in Lake County. That's $8 million for drug eradication and education and counseling alone, and nothing else. You know, they have $8 million they were already spending to stop the demand for drugs, and then the supply, most of this money is going overseas, all over Mexico, Central America, Colombia, Afghanistan, tremendous money over there. We're wasting it overseas, trying to stop the supply when we could eradicate demand overnight in the country with the money we're already spending. Yeah. I think this is another project for Veronica to pursue.
And Jennifer, you're going to take that project on?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know that we could eradicate the demand overnight, no matter how much we spent. But your caller does have a point, and it is a whole other topic to explore.
Yeah, thank you, Charles. We have a line for you and time for you if you want to weigh in on whether you think or what reforms you think the American prison system needs at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest Jennifer Gonerman wrote, "Slammed, Welcome to the Age of Incarceration." That's in the July-August issue of Mother Jones. And our next caller is Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Good morning. The only proper vehicle for prison reform is a bulldozer.
Why do you say that?
You have a prison industrial complex in this country, and it largely it's being fueled by rather corrupt politicians who like to campaign on "I'm tough on crime," and all they're tough on is community. As long as they get by with that nonsense, we're stuck. And the biggest part of the problem that hasn't been touched on this program is the privatization. And like a lot of other privatizations, it leads to disaster. And it leads to companies whose only real interest is money. And they don't give a damn what happens to people. And so they support and they send money to politicians who blab about tough on crime, and we're stuck with this monster. Mother Jones comes to this struggle a little late. It started almost 30 years ago.
Well, Jennifer, what about the privatization? You did talk about that briefly in one response. I know that.
Yeah, it certainly, it does. Your caller has a point, and similar to what the earlier caller was saying about the profit motive behind prisons, and certainly when you talk about private prisons, while there's still a small percentage of prisons overall, they are sort of insidious in the notion that they're really just there to make a profit. So it's not about rehabilitating people at all. It's about what is the least amount of money we can spend to house and feed and keep alive these inmates so that we can take home as much money as possible. And that is, I think, a very disturbing concept, the idea of outsourcing your criminal justice system.
Yeah. In Mother Jones, it's not just your article. As we mentioned in the very beginning of the program, there are a series of, seven articles in this particular issue regarding the correction system or the prison system. It was prompted in part by statistics like nearly 1 in 4 of all prisoners worldwide is incarcerated in America, which is a different statistic. 1 in 4 of all prisoners worldwide is actually imprisoned in America. And that was shocking to you and others at Mother Jones.
Exactly. I mean, it was just 8 years ago that the United States became or gained the dubious distinction of being the country with the highest per capita rate of incarceration. So, you know, that is something that's driven a lot of the media coverage in recent years, the idea that we are so out of step with the rest of the world and how we punish our citizens. And that's partly what drove Mother Jones to put together this 7-article package, which I would encourage, you know, your readers to pick up at the newsstand or to check out on motherjones.com. There's a number of terrific articles. There's one about the California Prison Guards Union, which for a long time continually lobbied very effectively, in fact, for more and more prisons, and recently has actually done a complete turnaround and is now, you know, urging people to rethink the size of the prison population, which is quite extraordinary. And there's an article about Kansas, which is at the forefront of rethinking the purpose of the parole system and trying to curb prison costs in that way. And there's a terrific article called Probation for Profit in Georgia's Outsourced Justice System, A Traffic Ticket Can Land You Deep in the Hole. That's the subtitle mm-hmm. of the story, and it's about how in Georgia, at least, they have outsourced probation, which means that a private company runs in some places the probation system. So that, and so, for example, if you get a traffic ticket and you can't pay a few hundred dollars fine, you end up being sort of outsourced to this company, which oversees, is supposed to oversee your supervision. And then, if you can't pay your fines, essentially they're almost acting as a collection agency. So if you can't pay your fines, you go deeper and deeper into the hole, and you know, the deeper you go, the more likely you're going to end up in jail at the end of it. So there's a lot of terrific information and ideas in this new issue of Mother Jones, and would really encourage your listeners to check it out if they're interested.
We're getting short on time. Lee in Eau Claire, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my comment is the cost of putting people in jails and prisons. Eau Claire recently pushed through a new jail without, you know, much public discussion or any referendum or anything. And we're at the same time, we're closing all these smaller local schools and consolidating kids in bigger and bigger schools. And the cost of housing a prisoner for a year, that's like the same cost as sending someone to college, including mm-hmm. tuition.
Yeah, and in our final minute, Jennifer, it's your hope that we make that connection?
Exactly. I mean, it may be more to send somebody to prison for a year. And, you know, it's one thing to ask voters, do you want to build a new jail or prison? Do you want to put more people behind bars? And you want us to be tough on crime, and who's, you know, people will say yes, that's a great idea. But if you ask them, would you like us to do all those things and spend less money on our public schools, then it becomes a very different question. I think that's the question that states and citizens are starting to ask themselves.
Yeah, and you are you're hopeful that there are some changes possible down the road.
Yeah, I think even from your callers, it's mm-hmm. apparent that people are starting to think more deeply about a lot of the ways that we punish our citizens.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We did have a lot of response. Thanks to Jennifer Gonerman, contributing writer to Mother Jones. Her article, Slammed, Welcome to the Age of Incarceration, joins about six others in the July-August issue of Mother Jones. Jennifer, also the author of the book, Life on the Outside, a 2004 National Book Award finalist. Thanks to Carmen Jackson, Cynthia Schuster, and Rob Ferret for producing this hour. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.